This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. Selling your car? Visit Carvana and enter your license plate or VIN. Answer a few quick questions and you can get a real offer in seconds. When you finalize your offer, Carvana will pick it up so you never have to leave the comfort of home. Visit Carvana.com or download the app.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. In 2008, David Ring was an experienced hand surgeon. He was the chair of the Quality and Safety Committee for the Orthopedic Department at Massachusetts General, one of the best hospitals in the country. And it wasn't going to be a very busy day for him.
This day I had six surgeries scheduled, which for a hand surgeon is not a lot because we do small surgeries.
The first three surgeries required general anesthesia for the patient. They all went well. Then David turned to a carpal tunnel surgery, which is done under local anesthesia.
And that patient, I knew, was very nervous about the shot for the local anesthetic.
David talked to the patient and tried to reassure her that it would all be okay. Soon, she seemed calm. Once she was prepped for surgery, he got started. When they were all done, David pulled aside the drape to tell the patient it went well.
What I saw was a traumatized person, like just really distraught.
He realized his efforts to calm her down had not worked after all. She looked absolutely terrified.
And it was heart-wrenching, and I took a moment to apologize and connect with her and soothe her. But it really affected me. Her anxiety, her terrible experience affected me.
David felt shaken, upset about this patient's experience, and he could feel the adrenaline rushing through his body. But he wanted to keep going, to refocus. So when it came time for his final surgery of the day, he was determined to do a great job.
I'm going to do the best carpal tunnel release I've ever done, thinking about the person that had the worst experience.
The surgery went well. David left feeling better. Back at his office, he started looking over patient paperwork. And that's when it hit him.
And I realized that I've done a carpal tunnel release when I should have done a trigger finger release.
He had performed the wrong surgery on his last patient.
It's hard to put into words how bad this feels. There's a split second where the mind can imagine that it didn't happen. You know, and then you just quickly beyond that, it's like it happened. It's like there's no air. It's like the floor just drops.
When medical mistakes happen, there is shock, shame, feelings of guilt, and then often silence. The mistake can become a legal matter. Reputations and financial interests are at stake. Patients and their families are at a loss trying to figure out what exactly went wrong. And providers often feel trapped in a cone of silence that's imposed on them, unable to face their mistake or to have open conversations about preventing future ones. On this episode, breaking the silence around medical mistakes, finding new solutions to avoid them, and putting patients' lives and safety first. To get started, let's find out what happened next with hand surgeon David Ring after he realized he made a big mistake. Liz Tung takes it from here.
The first thing David did after he realized his mistake was to call the OR and tell them what had happened. Then he went to do the hardest part, apologize to the patient, who we'll call Alma, to protect her privacy.
You know, she was in a chair sitting up. So I got down to her level, which meant I was on my knee. And I said, you know, I made a mistake.
David started to cry and Alma sat quietly. She was a stoic 65-year-old woman from the Caribbean who spoke only Spanish, a language David luckily was able to speak.
She was a woman of very few words. So she's just listening as I speak. And I said, if you want me to, I can take care of the trigger finger for you. And she said, yes.
David remembers this somber silence that settled over the unit as they again prepared for surgery. As he was walking down the hall, he spotted the director of the OR approaching him. The director pulled David into a room so they could talk.
And in my mind, I'm thinking, I'm in for it now. He's going to punish me. He's going to yell at me. He's going to, you know, I won't be able to operate for a while. And what he said actually was, how are you doing? And this is the part where I tear up, because at the moment that I was being the hardest on myself that I've ever been, or one of the hardest, he just cared about me.
After their talk, David pulled himself together and performed the trigger finger release. Then he discharged the patient and went home.
And that was a, needless to say, very sleepless night.
There ended up being no lasting damage for Alma, physically anyway. Her trigger finger was fixed, and the tendon David had cut during the carpal tunnel release would heal on its own. But for David, and likely Alma, the ordeal imprinted a lasting trauma. The days and weeks after were filled with soul-searching for David and the hospital. He had meetings with his colleagues, along with the Quality and Safety Committee, to review what had happened, why it had happened, and how it could be avoided in the future. It's the kind of mistake a lot of hospitals would be eager to bury as quickly as possible. But the administrators at David's hospital did the opposite. They proposed that he present the case at an upcoming conference.
Now, remember, I'm already a quality and safety advocate and champion in my hospital, so it was an easy yes. But it was also an easy yes because the thing that I dreaded most is walking down the hall past a colleague, and they know what the event that I've been through, and not being sure whether we can talk about it or not. So I really wanted to get up and talk about it. And I wanted to make something good out of it. I wanted to do the best I could with something that was awful, talking about it, being open about it.
And so David dove headfirst into a fact-finding mission to identify every factor that had contributed to his mistake, like a post-mortem after a death. In hindsight, David realized that the path towards his mistake started before he even got to the hospital. That morning, as he laid out his day, he thought about the 6 surgeries he had scheduled, 3 medium-sized ones and 3 smaller ones. Only 2 of the smaller ones were carpal tunnel releases. But without realizing it, his brain created a mental shortcut, 3 bigger surgeries and 3 carpal tunnels. It's a mistake he might easily have corrected if his day hadn't veered into chaos. The 3 bigger surgeries went fine, but things started going wrong with his first carpal tunnel surgery, the patient with the intense fear of local anesthesia. David knew about her anxiety and had talked her through everything several times. She seemed calm and ready. It wasn't until after the procedure that he saw the trauma on her face.
It was bad because it was like a violation of a trusting relationship.
And that feeling of guilt, regret, and pain followed David throughout the day, not only as a mental distraction, but a physical one, too.
All the adrenaline goes and the anxiety goes, and it just changes your mind and it changes your physiology.
So that was one big factor. Another was the chaos happening around David as he moved on to operate on Alma. For one thing, there was no interpreter available to translate for Alma. And so David, the only Spanish speaker around, was called in to walk her through the pre-operative prep. Later, because other surgeons were running behind, the operating room for Alma's surgery had to be changed at the last minute, which ended up causing 2 chain reactions. First, it meant a changeover in staff. Specifically, the nurse who prepped Alma before surgery and performed the safety check would no longer be present. Second, the room change created a delay. During this brief pause, while he was walking through the recovery unit, a nurse grabbed David. The patient with a fear of anesthesia, she told him, was decompensating.
Her anxiety and her bad feelings were, emotions were really spiraling.
David found her in a state, crying and hyperventilating.
Agitated, physically moving around, and almost unreachable, like it's hard to have a conversation with her.
He sat with her a while to try and calm her down.
I think it was helpful, but again, her emotions transferred to me. There's that emotion contagion or stress contagion.
David was thrust back into the same awful state he'd been in right after her surgery. And so on his way to Alma's procedure, his last of the day, he made that fateful resolution in his mind. I'm going to do the best carpal tunnel release I've ever performed. But from the beginning, the hiccups continued. When Alma's arm and hand were washed, it wiped off the site marking. The X marks the spot, used to ensure surgeons are operating in the right place. Most importantly, David says, the team never performed a timeout, a pre-surgery huddle, where they review who the patient is, what procedure they're about to do, where exactly it's being done, and any concerns they might have beforehand. It's a protocol recommended by the World Health Organization that David's hospital was 1 month away from officially adopting. David usually did his own version of a timeout anyway, but this time he was frazzled and upset. The room was in chaos, and as he later discovered, his nurse had assumed that his chit-chat with the patient in Spanish had been him confirming the procedure details. And then there was the cherry on top of the confusion sundae, a shift change right in the middle of the surgery, the second time that day that Alma's team had been switched out for a new one. In the final scheme of things, David realizes that all of it, the mental shortcut that made him think he was performing three carpal tunnels that day, the emotional turmoil from his earlier patient, the last-minute room and staffing changes, the language barrier that sowed confusion, all of it had contributed to David performing the wrong surgery. And so once he'd pieced everything together, David presented the case before a conference of his peers. Later, he published his account in the New England Journal of Medicine, and soon found that he was being asked to speak about it everywhere.
I would essentially just tell my story, as I'm doing today. And then I'd go to the back of the room, and people would swarm around me. And they all wanted to tell their story. And a part of their story was often, I was punished, I was shamed.
There is a famous report on medical errors that was published in 1999 called To Err is Human. And David says that's a sentiment that people in medicine seem to understand, that mistakes happen. And that's why it's important to have what he calls a good safety culture, multiple duplicated safety nets, so that when one fails, another one catches the mistake.
Everyone who's trained in quality and safety learns early on about James Reason's Swiss cheese theory. And the idea is that each safety system is a piece of Swiss cheese. It's not perfect. It's got holes in it. But you line up safety system upon safety system. And the only way an error leads to harm is if it goes through each of those safety systems, if the holes in the Swiss cheese line up. And this there couldn't be a more perfect example of that. My mind was stuck on carpal tunnel. I'm going to do the best carpal tunnel release I've ever done. The anxiety I was feeling because the patient had a bad experience. And that's the error. And then the error making it through all the layers of Swiss cheese because of everything I mentioned. There's so many things that could have kept my error from causing harm.
And safety culture isn't just about having the right protocols in place. It's about health workers feeling safe themselves about reporting their mistakes. Safe from punishment, safe from shaming, safe from being fired.
That story was reported by Liz Tung. A lot of factors can contribute to medical mistakes. We've heard about a few of them already. Poor communication, too much going on all at the same time, but also exhaustion, stress, and anxiety. Feeling anxious and stressed out in a work environment where mistakes not only have major potential consequences, they are also frowned upon, can create even more pressure. Some healthcare providers are trying to offer some relief. Grant Hill has more.
Pediatrician Joe Sherman was working at an academic health center years into his career when he realized that juggling the demands of teaching, doing administrative work, and taking care of patients was becoming totally overwhelming. He could not keep up.
In my experience, the more that I tried to make up for deficiencies within the system I was working, I became more and more anxious. And the more anxious I became, the more disconnected I became, the more dissociated I became a bit. And that becomes very distracting. You may not be able to focus that well on the matter at hand, what's happening in front of you, whether that's the patient in front of you, whether that's driving down the street. I can tell you, at the peak of my anxiety that I was experiencing, I had fender benders. I would be driving down the street and my mind would be in three different places worrying about things, and I just wasn't paying attention.
Beyond the fender benders, Joe was worried about the impact of his anxiety on his performance as a physician, on his patients.
It's just overwhelming. It's just too much. And so that can lead to mistakes. And it's bidirectional. If you happen to have made a mistake, and it's whether you've made a mistake or you've been accused of having a medical error, that in and of itself causes tremendous anxiety. Again, because we are brought up in a culture where mistakes are unacceptable.
Psychiatrist Mona Massoud says this is a message that is internalized by a lot of physicians.
We've kind of drank the Kool-Aid ourselves, that we cannot make mistakes and we cannot be human, that it does make you a bad physician, but worse, it makes you a bad person. That's what really is behind all of this stigma.
So doctors often keep quiet and refrain from talking freely about their anxieties and worries. Seems like a wise move in a profession where seeking treatment for mental health issues can create a stain on your resume. But then the pandemic started. Hospitals swelled over capacity. Physicians worked tirelessly. Even in between shifts, many didn't stop. Doctors took to private social media groups to discuss COVID-19 more informally, which treatments seemed to be working and which were not. Mona had joined some of those forums, and given her training, she picked up on a dark undercurrent beneath all the clinical talk.
What I saw was that physicians were struggling with their own anxieties about their mortality, worried about making mistakes and not being able to help people or, God forbid, harming their patients.
Mona thought she had to do something. She felt like those providers needed an outlet for their stress and anxiety, a safe place to share, to vent. So she posted in one of those groups, asking if other psychiatrists wanted to join her in building that space.
And the response was kind of remarkable.
Within 1 week, 200 psychiatrists responded, and together they launched the Physician Support Line, a 24/7 free peer-to-peer service that allows physicians to call in and talk about whatever they want, anything from their own mental health to mistakes.
Physicians listening to physicians anonymously, unapologetically, without fear of being reported.
Mona wasn't the only person who saw signs of crisis among healthcare providers during the early days of the pandemic.
Not having enough PPE, not having enough oxygenation systems, right? When they know that that's what their patients need, but they can't provide it. That's moral distress.
Amy King is a psychologist who specializes in pediatrics and trauma. Amy helps facilitate anonymous drop-in Zoom sessions for Physicians Anonymous, another organization started in the wake of the pandemic, working to reduce the alarming rise in burnout, moral injury, and even suicide among physicians. She says one issue that comes up frequently is the veil of silence that so many physicians live under after mistakes happen.
If you can imagine making some kind of a mistake that is dire or hurts or harms your patient somehow, and that your ethical heart would like to take responsibility for that, and yet you're being told by all of your liability and HR and litigation teams that you can't admit fault, that's distressing to our nervous system. It feels out of alignment with what we want to be able to do as human beings.
Pediatrician Joe Sherman, who started getting into fender benders at the height of his own burnout, also works with Physicians Anonymous, co-facilitating sessions with Amy. And his hunch about the impact of physicians being squeezed, how juggling too many tasks affects patient care, has been backed up. In 2018, researchers at Stanford found that doctors who self-reported having made a mistake were more than twice as likely to also report struggling with burnout. Joe has since reduced his hours as a pediatrician to part-time and started coaching other physicians, in addition to facilitating those sessions with Physicians Anonymous.
It's an opportunity for physicians who are struggling with burnout, with mental illness, mental distress, to show up in a group and share and heal.
Amy King says doctors are typically incentivized to stay quiet about their mental health struggles and concerns about their performance. Many state medical boards and health organizations still require doctors to reveal private information about their mental health, despite official recommendations from oversight agencies against doing so.
There's an inherent system that's set up that says, don't suffer. And certainly if you suffer, don't reach out for help. And that's pretty dangerous.
For now, Amy says grassroots efforts like Physicians Anonymous are providing doctors a lifeline and protecting patients too.
The research is really clear. When we provide space for physicians to reflect on what's gone well, what's gone right, what's gone wrong, to have those ability to debrief without condensation, without shame, without judgment, they feel more capable, more competent, more confident.
That story was reported by Grant Hill. Coming up, one family's fight to prevent medical mistakes and to honor their daughter's legacy.
I feel like if I change one life, there are many other lives that may be saved on account of that one change.
That's next on The Pulse.
On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation. I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Jasmine Morris here from the StoryCorps podcast. Our latest season is called My Way. Stories of people who found a rhythm all their own and marched to it throughout their lives. Consequences and other people's opinions be damned. You won't believe the courage and audacity in these stories. Hear them on the StoryCorps podcast from NPR.
Summer is for going to the movie theater because it's too hot to stay home. It's for driving with the windows down, listening to your favorite music. It's for stretching out while you're on vacation to gobble up a TV show. For a guide to some of the TV, movies, and music we are most excited about this summer, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about medical mistakes. After a mistake, patients and their families are often at a loss trying to figure out what exactly went wrong. Something bad happened, and suddenly communication drops. There's no real explanation and no apology. Everybody seems on guard. One couple is trying to change how hospitals handle the aftermath of mistakes. Their work is an effort to cope with a tragedy that struck their family and to honor their daughter. Nicole Curry has this profile.
The people who knew Talia Goldenberg best loved her personality, her strawberry blonde curly hair, her enormous blue eyes, which complemented her long eyelashes. But most of all, they just loved being around her.
She was so open and available.
Going skiing with her, going on road trips with her.
Those are Talia's parents, Jeff Goldenberg and Naomi Kirtner.
So whatever she was feeling, you knew, and she was open about them, and she could contain them, but express them, and she could hold them for you if you were feeling them. So for me, she was just so easy to be with.
For me, one of the things that she was able to straddle the two worlds of being somebody who could be like your buddy and friend and at the same time be in a father-daughter relationship.
They raised Talia in Eugene, Oregon. Jeff was a family doctor, and Naomi was a stay-at-home mom. The two spent a lot of time caring for Talia and her other siblings.
And as a little kid, she was constantly making things. And one of my favorite stories about her is that at Hanukkah, she would set up this Hanukkah factory and she'd put a sign on her door and nobody was allowed to enter. And then she would make gifts for every single family member.
She was always trying to do her best at whatever she did.
That mindset is what helped Talia manage an illness that was really changing her life. At 20, she was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, or EDS. It's a group of hereditary disorders that weaken connective tissues and make them really stretchy. Over time, ligaments become so loose that they can no longer stabilize structures like the neck. Talia faced issues with her neck. As a result, she experienced dizziness, brain fog, and neck pain. By this time, Talia was playing soccer at the collegiate level, and she had to quit the team. She used art to express her emotions about it all. She tried to stay positive and often sported a bedazzled neck brace. But eventually, she had to figure out the best procedure to stabilize her neck. Together with her parents, Talia spoke with several specialists and came up with a plan to fuse the vertebrae in her neck. That's what landed her in a local hospital in 2014. Talia was 23.
So while we had been told that the surgery went great, what she described was that she was having a really hard time breathing. She sounded like Darth Vader. She also kept saying, I can't open my mouth. I can't get, my jaw won't open. And she couldn't get more than a centimeter open in her mouth.
It was very strange also because as a physician, I generally never made it clear that I was a physician if I had to be in the hospital as a patient or with a family member, and had always felt like I didn't want people to feel like I was second-guessing them, and I just wanted them to do what they did best without me interfering. And when we saw Talia, within minutes, I just felt like, I think Talia's going to die if I don't say something. So I identified myself as a physician and was quite specific about the concerns I had of her airway becoming blocked and them not being able to get a tube in there to keep her airway open or to ventilate her.
They would have a really hard time doing that because of the nature of the surgery she had. You have to be able to bend a neck to intubate somebody. And
if you can't bend the neck well, you have to be able to open the mouth. And so her neck wouldn't bend, her mouth wouldn't open. That meant that there wouldn't be any typical way to get an airway in, apart from making it what they call a surgical airway, which would be creating an incision on the front of the neck and putting a tube in that way.
So we were scared and we got noisy.
A rapid response team came to Talia's care, and soon she was admitted to the ICU. Talia spoke to a doctor about her symptoms, and they tried various medicines to open her airway. Talia eventually seemed to settle, but by the next morning, she told her neurosurgeon during rounds that she was still having breathing issues. She also told him that she could barely open her jaw. No evaluations were given. Jeff and Naomi tried to get more care for Talia. Eventually, a speech therapist assessed her capacity to swallow and her ability to breathe and open her mouth. She made notes in her chart and left. But then, a nurse in the ICU told the couple,
"We're just waiting for a bed on the regular floor. We're transferring her out of the ICU." And I was incredulous, but it's like there was nothing I could do to move people to respond to what was happening to Talia.
About an hour later, Talia's condition took a drastic turn for the worse. She yelled out that she couldn't breathe. Staff first tried to intubate her, which didn't work because of her neck surgery and her inability to open her jaw. This being the same issue Jeff pointed out the day before. Soon, her oxygen levels dropped. Talia went into cardiac arrest. Staff finally did a cricothyrotomy. That's an emergency incision to open her airway. Talia's heartbeat came back, but she was unresponsive. Her brain had suffered a lot of damage, too much damage. She was taken off of life support 9 days later. Jeff and Naomi filed a lawsuit that resulted in a settlement. 3 years after Talia's death, in 2017, the Seattle Times published an investigation into medical errors at the hospital where Talia had been treated. This series resulted in an investigation by the Washington State Department of Health, or DOH. It gave new, more detailed information to Talia's parents.
There was just this failure at every level for the kind of, they called themselves a medical team, but there was no, the team part was what was missing.
Communication errors among the staff, not listening to Talia, and an invisible hierarchy were major culprits. The Seattle Times story got a lot of attention. Jeff and Naomi got letters from nurses and doctors, all offering condolences. Then one letter came from John Friedenberg, who at the time was the president and chief operating officer of Marin General Hospital in Greenbrae, California.
You know, mainly I just wanted to reach out to them as just, you know, one human being to another. I'm really sorry. But, you know, I also know if Jeff and Naomi came to my hospital and spoke to my team, that it would be very impactful.
John's hospital was addressing medical mistakes and finding new ways to prevent them. And one thing they were learning was that hierarchy plays a big role in communication errors.
You know, in a hospital setting, the doctor's the captain of the ship, as the doctor should be the captain of the ship. But if the captain of the ship is going to run the ship aground, then, you know, and the first officer doesn't say anything, then the lowest man or lowest woman on the totem pole needs to be able to speak up.
Jeff and Naomi agreed to visit John's hospital, and soon they were facing a crowd, recounting what had happened to Talia. Their story resonated with the audience. In fact, it was all too familiar for many in attendance.
They didn't feel that they could speak up because of the way a physician would react, and that they might have felt that a patient wasn't ready for discharge because of what they were seeing, but they knew the physician was planning on discharging the patient and would get upset if they spoke up, so they didn't.
The response was overwhelming. Jeff and Naomi got a standing ovation, and John thought they could do this sort of thing often.
I mean, I told them that I thought that their presentation was so powerful and so important and so impactful that if they wanted to, they could give that presentation 48 times a year.
But for Jeff and Naomi, they were conflicted.
Just the thought of people congratulating us for talking or telling us how good it is that we're doing this or applauding, it just all felt kind of awful. Like, you know, this is
somehow
like
we were capitalizing.
Me getting something positive out of Talia's death. Naomi and I talked afterward, and I said that if we were going to do this, I wanted it to be that I knew that what we were doing was having some impact, that I wasn't just walking in somewhere to be the sad story of the week.
Eventually, Jeff and Naomi came up with a few concrete ideas. They started a nonprofit called Talia's Voice and began partnering with the Collaborative for Accountability and Improvement at the University of Washington in Seattle. they push for something called Communication Resolution Programs, or CRPs. Medical centers that have this program commit to investigating adverse events right when they happen, making appropriate apologies, and ensuring the family is heard and involved every step of the way.
Basically, what we do all over society, for lack of a better term, for consumer protection, if all the airlines went dead silent every time there was something went wrong with a plane, what would be happening is that there would be a lot of planes having that same problem and a lot more people would be getting hurt.
CRPs essentially provide transparency. And the idea is that if you are transparent, you can easily pinpoint how harm was done and you can avoid repeating the same mistake again. There is a national group, the Joint Commission of Accredited Healthcare Organizations, to which institutions can report adverse events, but it's voluntary. It's hard to know why institutions don't report things, but anecdotal evidence can suggest a fear of facing lawsuits. However, Jeff says research shows this isn't always true.
It appears that the fear that most institutions have about, oh, malpractice costs will go through the roof, are quite unfounded, and it looks like malpractice costs actually have gone down in those places.
For example, when the University of Illinois Hospital and Health Sciences System adopted a CRP, research showed that the number of incident reports doubled, but the hospital's number of legal claims went down by 50%. Legal costs and settlement amounts were also lowered.
A lot of people say that's because patients are bringing a lawsuit so they can find out what happened, so that somebody will talk about it. I'd like to think it's also because if you investigate what happens and make your hospital safer, fewer people die.
Talia's voice has been in operation since 2018. Today, more than 400 hospitals in the U.S. have adopted a communication resolution program. In addition to this work, Jeff and Naomi are raising money to fund patient safety research for Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore and for the University of Washington in Seattle. Jeff and Naomi never expected to be in this line of work, pushing for change in hospital culture, but they also never expected to lose their daughter, an experience they wouldn't want anyone else to endure. So, these two are really in it for the long run.
You know, it's interesting. There's a saying in the Talmud that if you save a life, it's as if you saved the whole world. And if you destroy a life, it's as if you destroyed the whole world. And I hold that kind of proverb statement close when I am speaking publicly, because I feel like if I change one life, there are many other lives that may be saved on account of that one change. And it's also important to me because things move so slow in medicine. It's a broken system, but I feel like I'm part of a movement that is bringing about real change that is meaningful and that will save lives.
That story was reported by Nicole Curry. We're talking about medical mistakes. Coming up, what happens when a pattern of mistakes and even misconduct emerges?
Prior to the case in question, he already sort of had an established reputation. I mean, because patient E, whose case I was involved in, was not the first bad outcome.
That's next on The Pulse.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
In any great story, there's a moment that sparks your curiosity. It tells you there is more to uncover.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
That's where Embedded comes in. We are NPR's home for documentary journalism, immersive and intimate stories.
I was stone cold speechless.
Nothing will ever, 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 ever be the same here.
Find Embedded wherever you get your podcasts.
When the economic news gets to be a bit much,
listen to The Indicator from Planet Money. We're here for you, like your friends, trying to figure out all the most confusing parts. One story, one idea, every day, all in 10 minutes or less.
The Indicator from Planet Money, your friendly economic sidekick.
From NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me isn't just jokes about the week's news. It's also life hacks. For example, here's actor Karen Allen revealing how she got her starring role in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
They said, how well can you spit? And I just found it coming out of my mouth. I said, oh, I can hawk him with the best.
I'm Peter Sagal. If you want to increase your self-confidence, then listen to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me podcast from NPR.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about medical mistakes. What happens when there is a pattern of mistakes or bad outcomes, all related to the same physician? The podcast series Imminent Danger from WNYC and Gothamist traces the path of an OBGYN named Thomas J. Byrne. Back in the early 90s, New York State found him to be dangerous, negligent, and fraudulent. They even took away his medical license. Then, years later, the state gave it back to him. They said he was rehabilitated, fit to practice, and he's still practicing today. Let's hear an excerpt from the series. Here, reporter Karen Shikurji is talking to Donita Henry, one of Dr. Byrne's former patients.
What did happen in your case?
Okay, so on May 3rd of 1990, I went in for a regular checkup.
Back in 1990, Donita was 25 years old, and she was living in the Finger Lakes area of upstate New York. She was 9 months pregnant and seeing Dr. Byrne for care.
This was my first child, so I did not know what to expect. I'm going to trust my doctor, obviously. And he had told me my blood pressure was high, and he said, okay, if you don't go into labor, I need to induce you.
At 8 p.m. that same night, Donita was admitted to Newark Wayne Community Hospital.
I do remember that I just wasn't going into labor, and they had to break my water.
24 hours later, she still hadn't given birth, and by that point, her temperature shot up to 102.2, the baby's heart rate was rising, and Donita was still not fully dilated. The state's public record says Dr. Byrne told her to start pushing anyway, which an expert witness for the health department would later say was the wrong thing to do. Were you there in the room when all of this was unfolding?
Yes.
Michelle Durham was a labor and delivery nurse at the time. She was working that night, taking care of Donita and assisting Dr. Byrne. What was it like in there?
From what I recall, I had an impending feeling of, I don't want to sound dramatic, but doom. Like, this is not going the way it should. Her temperature started to creep up. She developed fetal tachycardia, and she wasn't showing the cervical change that she should have. And I think that when you do something in medicine long enough, you develop like a sixth sense. And there are certain cases and bad outcomes specifically, you just don't forget.
Can you describe Dr. Byrne? I mean, I'm interested in what your impressions of him were.
I would say compared to the many physicians I had worked with, I don't know how to say this. You know, he was kind of a cowboy. He would just be much more aggressive in the care of a patient. And I think it made a lot of people uncomfortable.
Michelle also testified as a witness in the investigation into Dr. Byrne. She refers to Donita as patient E because the state records anonymize patients to protect their privacy.
So prior to the case in question, he already sort of had an established reputation. I mean, because patient E, whose case I was involved in, was not the first bad outcome. I mean, there had been many previous bad outcomes.
That was an excerpt from Imminent Danger, One Doctor and a Trail of Injured Women from WNYC and Gothamist. Donita's baby died a day after she was born. In the investigation, healthcare providers testified and the state ultimately found the doctor deviated from acceptable medical care 15 times while caring for Donita, which caused or contributed to her daughter's death. But as reporter Karen Shakurji found out, this doctor's story does not end with this tragic incident.
The state investigated other cases besides Donita's and eventually found Dr. Byrne guilty of things like incompetence, negligence, and fraud. And by 1991, they took away his medical license. But what I found is that he went on to practice in other states, and that he still is, and that New York eventually gave him his license back. Overall, I've found 23 lawsuits filed against him in multiple states, and former patients and colleagues who've raised a lot of concerns about their experiences with him. A lot of these lawsuits are related to gynecological surgeries like hysterectomies, but also births. Most recently, two lawsuits were filed against him related to medical care he gave at Harlem Hospital in New York City in 2016 and 2020.
How was Dr. Byrne able to get his medical license back, and how was he able to continue practicing despite all of these lawsuits?
So one of the things that I found that happened shortly after his license was revoked in New York State is that he participated in a program that's kind of geared toward rehabilitation, retraining, re-education of physicians who are in difficult moments in their career for one reason or another. The one that he went to was in Syracuse in New York. It's no longer running. It was called the Physician Prescribed Educational Program. And eventually, after participating in that program, Dr. Byrne got a license in New Mexico and began working there.
And what did you find out in terms of, you know, when a doctor applies for a new job, do they have an obligation to disclose anything that has happened somewhere else, like losing their medical license in a different state? Or does the hospital have a way of finding that out?
So what I found is, just to talk about Dr. Byrne's career and kind of his background, I found a total of 23 malpractice cases,
mm-hmm.
In addition to the license revocation in New York. And there's kind of a couple of ways that you might be able to access information about him. So at the local level, like hospitals would be able to find information about him. At the state level, medical boards would be able to. And then at the national level, there are these databases that are meant to be fed with information and then later checked. Hospitals can access information about a physician's past through a number of ways, including two databases. So one is called the National Practitioner Databank, and the other is hosted by the Federation of State Medical Boards.
Through your reporting, did you get a sense whether or not hospitals routinely check this kind of information?
So what's interesting about the National Practitioner Databank is that hospitals are legally obligated to report certain issues that they encounter with doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got some numbers from this federal agency that runs the databank.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me that in the 30 years that the databank has existed, about 45% of hospitals have never submitted even one clinical report involving adverse actions taken to a doctor's privileges. There are other things that you would potentially report to the databank. It's not just about a physician's clinical privileges, but that is one of the things that hospitals are obligated to report. And so the information in this databank is only as good as the information that is put into the databank. So the idea is that hospitals are supposed to feed it with information, and then they are supposed to check it. And if it is not getting fed with information the way that it's supposed to, that means that if I'm looking up a physician in the databank, I'm not going to potentially see as much as I could or should.
Who? Well, that leaves me, as a potential patient, leaves me thinking that the safety net is not as solid as I had assumed it was. Did you learn why? And if that can be enforced, or if anybody is checking up on that?
What I found is that the reasons for not feeding the database, according to experts that I spoke to, is multifaceted. I think underreporting is one of those complicated issues. And I was able to speak with this woman named Nadia Sawicki. She's a law professor at Loyola University in Chicago. And Nadia, she broke it down for me.
If you are a hospital employing a doctor, or if you are a colleague of a doctor who has done something shady, there are reputational disadvantages to reporting them, right? Holy Cross Hospital reports their key doctor as violating some really important principles. That is not going to reflect well on the hospital. That's the most obvious thing. The other issue is that there's really no enforcement mechanism for these reporting requirements. In other words, as a practical matter, if a hospital, if a malpractice insurer fails to report a misbehaving doctor to the data bank, practically speaking, no one is going to catch that.
Now, throughout your reporting, you tried and tried and tried to get in touch with Dr. Byrne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I reached out to him several times via email, phone calls, texts. Others on the WNYC team went and kind of visited the places where he works and to see if that, you know, maybe he would be willing to speak, but he declined.
Where is he now?
So as far as we know, he is still working in Amarillo in Texas. He's affiliated with a clinic there that's part of the Texas Tech system and a clinic in the Bronx in New York, St. Barnabas.
And then one more question, Karen. You're a reporter. You were able to access all of this information, dig up files and so on. In terms of, you know, if I'm just a regular patient who knows how to use Google, am I able to find this kind of information? Can I run a bit of a background check on a doctor I'm considering for maybe a bigger surgery?
So there's ways that you can access information beyond just Googling a physician, right? So there's going to be reviews and various things that pop up. Maybe you'll find legal action taken against the doctor, maybe you won't, but other than Google, there's looking your doctor up at the website of your state medical board. Anybody can do this. You can go onto a website, you can type in your doctor's name, and you will see if your state has taken any disciplinary action against the doctor that you're wondering about. The other thing you can do is go to the Federation of State Medical Boards. They have a site called docinfo.org. Mm-hmm. And what's helpful about their database is that you type in a doctor's name and it will pull up any disciplinary action taken against that physician across states.
Mm.
So if you know that the doctor you're potentially seeing has practiced in other states and you're curious, instead of going and checking every individual state, go to docinfo.org, type in the doctor's name, and up pops this kind of profile. Where have they practiced? Where are they licensed? And have they had any disciplinary action? Now, you might have to go and like kind of dig around a little bit more once you see if there's anything, but that at least gives you some kind of basic map about a doctor's profile.
That was reporter Karen Chakurji talking about the podcast series Imminent Danger, One Doctor and a Trail of Injured Women from WNYC and Gothamist. We'll put a link to the series on our website. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia, made possible with support from our founding sponsor, the Sutherland Family, and the Commonwealth Fund. You can follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Grant Hill. Marcus Biddle is our Health Equity Fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Our producers are Nicole Curry and Lindsay Lazarski. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
On the TED Radio Hour, researcher Sasha Lucioni says AI can help us find climate solutions. But just training the technology itself uses a ton of energy.
Training ChatGPT, for instance, emits as much carbon as 5 cars in their lifetime.
Tech's Climate Conundrum. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The economy right now is bewildering, impenetrable, inconceivable.
Not when you have the Indicator podcast in your ears. In under 10 minutes every day, we simplify the complicated news like...
How does inflation drop? What the heck is a SPAC? Why are trendy little high-fiber sodas suddenly dominating store shelves?
And more. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money and NPR.
Drake and Kendrick Lamar have been lobbing some serious accusations at each other. You've probably heard the diss tracks and wondered, what's just a low blow and what's actually criminal? I'm Brittany Luce, host of It's Been a Minute from NPR, and I'm getting into what's art and what's worthy of criminal investigation and who those accusations hurt the most on It's Been a Minute from NPR.